In one of his poems, Hilaire Belloc wrote, "From quiet homes and first beginning, out to the undiscovered ends, there's nothing worth the wear of winning but laughter and the love of friends." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. When we came up with the theme for this year's Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, No Greater Gift, Friendship from the Iliad to Facebook, we knew we wanted Wyoming Catholic College President Dr. Glenn Arbery to discuss the friendship between Achilles and Patroclus in Homer's epic. What no one expected was that Dr. Arbery would pair that friendship with the friendship Herman Melville describes in Moby Dick, the strange friendship between Ishmael and Queequeg. Here are Dr. Arbery's comments.
The way I want to do this, to get you involved in the discussion this morning, is for me to kind of set up what you actually had in your packet, which was book 16 of the Iliad and the section from Moby Dick called A Bosom Friend. What I want to do is just give you the kind of context of that particular reading, and then dig into what we're looking at with friendship in these selections. So starting with the Iliad, we don't really see the friendship of Patroclus and Achilles as it used to be in the Iliad. There's a long foreground to the action of this poem that is pretty much omitted from the poem itself. We don't know the kind of caliber of warrior that Achilles was in the years before the action of the poem starts. We begin to infer it as the poem goes on. We don't know what the nature of the friendship was between Patroclus and Achilles until we get well along into the poem. So by book 16 of the Iliad, which is what you have, we start to see what that friendship might look like. But when we find out what it had looked like, we only get that when we get to book 23, which is after Patroclus is dead and the ghost of Patroclus comes to visit Achilles and asks for a speedy burial. The other shades are keeping Patroclus at a distance. They won't let him enter the underworld and be at a new kind of peace until the burial, the burning, you know, of his body and the rituals can take place. So why don't we start there? As with so much in the Iliad, you start without knowing the full consequences of things, and as you go through the action, the consequences begin to deepen until finally by the end it's inescapable. So this is Patroclus after he's asked for burial, this kind of reminiscing in effect with Achilles about the nature of their friendship. "No longer shall you and I, alive, sit apart from our other beloved companions and make our plans, since the bitter destiny that was given me when I was born has opened its jaws to take me. And you, Achilles, like the gods, have your own destiny, to be killed under the wall of the prospering Trojans. There is one more thing I will say and ask of you, if you will only obey me. Do not have my bones laid apart from yours, Achilles, but with them, just as we grew up together in your house when Menoetius brought me there from Opus when I was little, and into your house by reason of a baneful manslaying on that day when I killed the son of Amphidamus. I was a child only, nor intended it, but was angered over a dice game. There the rider Peleus took me into his own house and brought me carefully up and named me to be your henchman. Therefore, let one single vessel, the golden two-handled urn the lady your mother gave you, hold both our ashes." So the nature of the friendship is so close, you know, that Patroclus is asking that they be buried together, have their ashes in the same urn. But we don't sense that much of this earlier in the poem, and I want to kind of go through how that works out. Everything you see in book 16 shows Achilles as this man who is incredibly obsessed with his own honor. right? He can't let go of the insult that has been dealt to him earlier in the poem. What he's talking about there is what happens at the very beginning of the Iliad. So there's an old man named Chryseis, who comes down along the beach where the Achaean ships are drawn up. If you know sort of the story, basically, let's say the city of Troy is over here. You know, the beach is somewhere down here. There's a river running through here. Now, along the beach of the sea, all the Achaean ships are drawn up. So, you know, they're probably in the neighborhood of 1,000 ships that are drawn up along the beach. The shelters of all the Achaeans are built, you know, among the ships, and the Achaeans, since the withdrawal of Achilles, have built a wall which has gates in it and has a ditch outside it to keep the horses from coming in. The ditch is full of sharpened stakes and so on. But this is a fairly late development in the war. So just to rehearse the beginning, old Chryseis, the old man, lands somewhere along the beach here and brings along to the Achaean commander, Agamemnon, this wagon load full of gold and silver and other gifts to ransom back his daughter, who has been stolen or taken in the sack of a city by the Achaeans. Her name is Chryseis. He offers this huge ransom if the Greeks, the Achaeans, will give her back to him so he can take her back to his own home. Agamemnon refuses this ransom. He does so because he loves her, and he says that he likes this girl better than he likes his own wife. This will not turn out well for him later. His return home is somewhat unfortunate in that regard. But when he says this and refuses the old man's ransom, the old man, who happens to be a priest of Apollo, goes along the beach praying to Apollo, you know, who is, it's not just he who has been dishonored, it's the god himself, since the old man has the ribbons of Apollo on his staff, and Agamemnon has insulted not just him, but the god. Apollo sends down this plague on the Achaean army, starts with the dogs, spreads to the men. For 9 or 10 days, people are dying. Corpse fires are burning everywhere. Nobody's doing anything until Achilles stands up, intervenes, and says, "We must do something. Let's ask a prophet, let's ask a soothsayer to step in and tell us why it is that Apollo is so angry." Not that anybody is any doubt, you suspect, right? It's more a matter of Agamemnon's sway over everybody that keeps this truth from coming out. So the prophet Calchas says, "Apollo is angry, you have to give the girl back and, you know, send offerings with her to the old man because of the offense that you've given." This infuriates Agamemnon. He's especially furious because Achilles has initiated it. So this quarrel breaks out between the two of them. Agamemnon says, "If I have to give my girl back," and you understand who these girls are, these are prizes taken in war. You sack a city, you kill the men, often you kill the infants, you enslave the children, and you take the women as prizes of war. The more beautiful ones are doled out to particular warriors as indications of their merit, how good they are, how important they are to the army. Agamemnon had Chryseis given to him, and Achilles' own prize is a girl named Briseis. So Agamemnon says, "If I have to give my prize away, I have to be compensated. I can't be stripped of my honor, you know, in this way. So I'm going to take somebody else's." And Achilles says, "What, do you think we just have a stockpile of girls, you know?" So Agamemnon's fury is such that, forgetting his own need, forgetting the army's dependence on Achilles, he says, "So I'm going to take yours." And Achilles almost kills him. Athena has to step in to stop him, but then he agrees to give the girl up, since Agamemnon, the king, is the distributor of these gifts to start with. But it infuriates Achilles so much that he brings this curse down on the Achaeans and says, "This shall be a great oath before you. Someday, longing for Achilles will come to the sons of the Achaeans, all of them. Then, stricken at heart though you be, you will be able to do nothing when in their numbers before manslaughtering Hector they drop and die. And then you will eat out the heart within you in sorrow that you did no honor to the best of the Achaeans." So Achilles makes this obviously painful decision to bring a curse on the entire army, not just on Agamemnon, but on the entire army, since nobody stood up for him, right? Nobody said how valuable he was to the army. So a curse on all of them, which is basically, you know, your sort of fantasy of how important you are. "I'm going to step out now, and everything's going to collapse," you know? Well, when Achilles does it, it in fact happens exactly that way. Largely because Achilles' mother, Thetis, goes to Zeus, the head god, and asks that his honor be restored. Now, this is not an inconsequential request. Those of you who were here last year remember the story. When Thetis was being pursued, before she was ever married, she was being pursued by Poseidon and Zeus. And the goddess Themis, who is the kind of prophetess among the gods, saw that the destiny that went with Thetis is that whoever she married, the son would be greater than the father. So if Zeus marries Thetis, has a child, we're looking at a kind of overthrow of the whole order of the Olympian gods, if the son is greater than the father. Just as Zeus was greater than his father Cronos, and Cronos was greater than his father Uranus. So instead of facing a situation like this, the gods force Thetis to marry a mortal, Peleus. And so they kind of take that destiny and push it down into the mortal realm so that it will play itself out without harming the order of the Olympian gods. But you can't do that without consequences, right? So Zeus owes Thetis, and the whole issue of the forced marriage comes up very prominently later in the poem. Again, you know, in book 18 it comes up, and again in 24. But when Zeus takes away, in effect, that supreme immortality from the son of Thetis, there's a debt incurred. And so what we're looking at in the Iliad is a kind of compensatory honor, an honor that will be everlasting, that will in some way balance what was taken away from Achilles in being born as a mortal. But it's going to be extraordinarily painful to bring about the kind of honor that will have the consequences that will keep us reading the Iliad, let's say 3,000 years later, right? What is it about this poem that's so consequential? So the debt that Zeus owes to Thetis is being invoked, right? He's asked for his honor. And so because of the curse that Achilles has put on the army, Hector becomes the focus of our attention. They're going to drop and die in front of manslaughtering Hector. It's explicitly mentioned in Achilles' own oath. So what does that make Hector? If you kind of took Achilles' negative, right, toward the army and embodied it in someone else, that would be Hector. In effect, Hector is acting as a sort of proxy of Achilles. You follow me? So he's everything that Hector achieves, all the glory he gains for himself as the attacker of the Achaeans, increases Achilles' glory every moment because it shows how necessary Achilles is to the defense of the Achaeans. So Hector is a kind of other self of Achilles, if you follow me. He's the sort of negative, the shadow, you know, who's pressing the Achaeans back within their own ships. So by the time you get a third of the way through the poem, Hector and the Trojans have already pushed the Achaeans back inside this wall. Just as a little footnote, this wall didn't exist until Achilles withdrew from the army. The first day of fighting, first complete day of fighting, old Nestor, you know, the wise old Achaean, says, you know what? I think we better build a wall around the ships. So when they start burying the dead from that first day of battle, they just, you know, and they're making the mounds, they just continue them and build this wall, which is, you know, more or less, temporary. It's not like the walls of Troy, but it keeps the Trojans out, at least for the time being. By the time you get to the end of Book 8, the Achaeans are pressed back inside this wall they've just built. Hector and the Trojans have campfires all over the plain. It's the first time they've been outside their own city since the beginning of the war. Because of what, right? Because of their terror of Achilles, though it takes a while for you to realize this. So in Book 9 of the Iliad, Agamemnon has seen the light. He sends several warriors to Achilles to plead with him to come back and join the army. Achilles refuses, and then on the next day of battle, more and more of them are wounded. And so by the end of Book 15, just before where we are starting our reading, the Trojans have penetrated. They're all the way up to the ships. So the fighting is taking place around the inmost ship of the Achaeans, the first one to land. This is a little footnote. This is the ship of a man named Protesilaus, who was the first one to die at Troy. He's the first ship that they attack and set on fire, which is what you see in Book 16. Remember when Achilles says, "That's it. All right, it's time for you to enter." Okay, now Patroclus himself. When you look back through the Iliad and look at what the relationship between them has been from Book 1, this is when the heralds of Agamemnon come to take Briseis from Achilles' shelter. So this is just after the quarrel. This is Achilles speaking. "Welcome, herald, messengers of Zeus and of mortals. Draw near. You are not to blame in my sight, but Agamemnon, who sent the two of you here for the sake of the girl Briseis. Go then, illustrious Patroclus, and bring the girl forth and give her to these to be taken away. Yet let them be witnesses in the sight of the blessed gods, in the sight of mortal men and this cruel king, if ever hereafter there shall be need of me to beat back the shameful destruction from the rest." So he spoke. And Patroclus obeyed his beloved companion. He led forth from the hut Briseis of the fair cheeks and gave her to be taken away. So if you're thinking in terms of friendship, this is not exactly an equal relationship, is it? Patroclus is obviously close to him, right? But, you know, Patroclus is the one you say, okay, how about making some dinner ready, right? No, seriously, you know. So Patroclus takes the girl. It's interesting that here he's the one who takes Briseis out and has her led away, because there's a parallel between Briseis and Patroclus. All right? I mean, when you see Briseis, she's the first taken from him. Patroclus is the second one taken from him. So Patroclus takes Briseis away, and then Patroclus himself, you know, is the second loss, in effect, that Achilles is going to undergo. Okay, for Book 9, when the other warriors come to ask Achilles to return to the fighting, again, look at the relation here. Basically, same relation we saw right? It's interesting that Achilles is playing the lyre and singing of men's fame. You know, there's a kind of musical dimension to Achilles, and obviously what he's singing is the same kind of song that's being sung about him in the Iliad itself, right? This kind of story of fame. But Patroclus is silent. He has no speaking part here. The other men come in. Patroclus, gets up to greet them. But notice he's sitting alone in silence, watching Iocides and the time he would leave off singing. It's like he's attending him. He's paying attention to whatever it is, that will be his next move. Well, it's, would you like to explain that a little bit? Sitting in silence. That was interesting. No, it does feel like that, though, right? It feels like he's, somehow, lifelike. And again, I'm with, what Jim said last night about Jonathan and David, the homoerotic dimension here. Later in the Greek tradition, it's clear that, say in Plato, that this is interpreted as homoerotic. I don't see a hint of it in the Iliad, except, this kind of relationship between the henchman and the man that he serves. I just don't see it. I mean, if you see it, let me know. But, Briseis seems to be the girl that Achilles loves. And it seems to me much more like Jim was describing Jonathan and David here. In any case, when we get to book 16, we are looking at a different Patroclus. He's obviously full of speech at this point. Achilles has sent him out a few books earlier to check on what's going on because he keeps seeing people get wounded. And so Patroclus goes to the shelter of Nestor, and Nestor tells him his own story and then begins to urge Patroclus that if Achilles himself won't return to the fighting, that maybe he can convince him to let him use his armor and return in his stead. So when we get to book 16 and Patroclus returns, if you look at the opening pages of that section, Achilles sees him and Patroclus comes in weeping. Weeping for what? For the death of all their friends, right? These are the friends that Achilles has in effect cursed, right, to die in his absence. So Patroclus, in the course of these books of the poem, has moved from being a kind of silent ally of Achilles to being an outspoken advocate for the rest of the men who are dying because of Achilles' insistence on his own honor. When you were looking at the relationship between Achilles and Patroclus here, we're looking at one that's entirely mediated by the question of honor. Achilles wants his honor. And he wants Patroclus to serve his honor in being his friend. And now Patroclus is, in effect, stepping in on the other side. What does this look like? Patroclus comes in, and Achilles mocks him. All right, oh, boo-hoo. What are you running around like some poor little girl, begging to be picked up? What's the problem, Patroclus, right? Are you crying for your father? You heard that he died, or my father? Or is it these Argives, right, who are being beaten? And Patroclus voices the same kind of outright criticism of Achilles that we've seen earlier. Agamemnon criticizes him. Others do. But when Patroclus does it, he says, this is about line 29. But you, Achilles, who can do anything with you? May no such anger take me as this that you cherish. Curse courage. What other man born hereafter shall be advantaged unless you beat aside from the Argives this shameful destruction? Pitiless, the writer Peleus was never your father, nor Thetis was your mother, but it was the gray sea that bore you, and the towering rocks, so sheer the heart in you is turned from us. So this is something inhuman, right? The kind of sheer, almost rock-like, elemental refusal, you know, to hear the suffering of the others. And then if you're drawing back from some prophecy known in your own heart, then at least send me in. You know, let the rest of the Myrmidon people fight, and I can be a light given to the Danaans. So if you're picturing this, let's say Achilles' shelter, you know, is way down here at this end. Did you pick up the number of Myrmidons who are present? They've also been held out of the fighting. They brought 50 ships with them when they came there. Each ship had 50 men, so we're looking at a force of 2,500 warriors, right, who have been held out of the fighting. Now all the Trojans are pressing into the ships. Suddenly, from the flank, unexpectedly, right, 2,500 men are going to come charging down, and it you know, it's like Stonewall Jackson at Chancellorsville. Sorry. Rolling up the flank, you know. Anyway, so they're pushing all these guys back down, and that's, you know, by itself, that would be a pretty major attack. You see what I'm saying? It wouldn't necessarily need Patroclus to be dressed in the armor of Achilles. So that's what I want us to puzzle out a little bit. When Achilles agrees to this, he says, yeah, why don't you put my armor on and go out there, and the Trojans, when they see me coming, it will be, you'll give a light, you know, to the Argives. So what does it mean, do you think, when Achilles says, you can be me? He wouldn't say this to anybody else, obviously. He wouldn't say it to Diomedes. You know, he's had great days in battle. He would never say it to Odysseus. But he says it to Patroclus. You can dress in my armor, and you can go out there, and as soon as you show yourself, it's going to be panic day, you know, for the Trojans. Why that? In other words, why not just have Patroclus go out as himself, leading these 2,500 men? You follow? You know, Patroclus is a pretty great warrior, as we see from the rest of Book 16. I hope you enjoyed all those skulls splitting. He knows that if he returns to the fighting, then he's going to die at Troy. He's holding himself out. That's, you know, there are mixed motives here. His mother's told him, you have two destinies. One is you can go back to our homeland, and you can live a long life, but without any particular glory. But if you stay here, if you enter the fighting, you're going to die here, but your glory will be everlasting. So he's kind of fudging, right? In terms of the candor we were talking about last night, we don't get it right here, right? If you look at about line 100, I wish all of them could die. All the Trojans, all the Argives, and just the two of us, you know, would get the glory of taking Troy. We were talking last night about, you know, this kind of military thing, why men die for each other. It's not for an abstraction. It's for, you know, it's for the guys that you know. Seriously, the Trojans have not come out of their city because Achilles is out there. The Achaeans have not had a wall because Achilles is there. And the more you get into the poem, the more you see how definitely this is the case. As soon as he's absent, the wall goes up, Trojans come out, right? So you send Achilles into the fighting, it looks like, right? So you're counting on that first few moments of panic. They are friends. So what I'm trying to get us to think about is how this obsession with his own honor, it erodes, you know, or kind of destroys or maybe betrays the character of that friendship. That's what I'm actually wondering about here. Patroclus goes far beyond what Achilles asked him to do. Achilles wanted him, all right, get him out of here, right? Get him outside the wall, push him away, and then come back, all right? And when Patroclus gets into it, the intoxication of battle overcomes him. He is amazing, right? I mean, he kills like 9 at a time, you know. He almost gets into Troy itself, and Apollo has to intervene, you know, to push him back. He kills the son of Zeus, Sarpedon, and Zeus cries tears of blood when he recognizes what is about to happen to his son. And even has a quarrel with Hera about it, you know, and Hera says, yeah, save him, but all the other gods have children out here. They're going to also want you to change destiny for them. So he has to concede to what he sees is coming. So in order, all right, just take it in, right? In order to honor Achilles, Zeus has to let his own son be killed, not by Achilles himself, but by the friend, the proxy of Achilles, the man dressed in his armor. So this is, you know, this is extremely serious stuff that's going on with the working out of Achilles' honor. Okay, I want to give us some time also to get to Moby Dick, but also want us to have enough time with this. What does it mean when to say that Patroclus is besotted? This is line 685. Besotted. Had he only kept the command of Peleides, he might have gotten clear away from the evil spirit of Black Death. No longer thinking about Achilles, right? No longer concerned about the fame that he's trying to preserve or the honor of Achilles. You see what I'm saying? So Patroclus gets into it so much. By this time, is anybody still under the illusion that this is Achilles? I don't think so. So Patroclus oversteps because he's so besotted. He goes up against Apollo himself. And then there's this just incredible moment in the poem when Apollo comes in against Patroclus and, you know, the god comes into battle and strikes Patroclus on the back and all the armor comes off. Okay, so let's look at this, about line 785, or 790. Phoebus came against you there. Notice this is one of the few times in the poem when the poet addresses the character in the poem. You know, he does this with Menelaus, he does it with Patroclus, but in any case. Phoebus came against you there in the strong encounter. Nor did Patroclus see him as he moved through the battle, and shrouded in a deep mist came in against him and struck his back and his broad shoulders. Phoebus Apollo now struck away from his head the helmet, four-horned and hollow-eyed, and under the feet of the horses it rolled, clattering, and the plumes above it were defiled by blood and dust. Before this time, it had not been permitted to defile in the dust this great helmet crested in horsehair. Rather, it guarded the head and the gracious brow of a godlike man, Achilles. But now Zeus gave it over to Hector to wear on his head, Hector, whose own death was close to him. The helmet goes, the shield goes, the corselet, right, which protects his torso, goes, and there is Patroclus standing, you know, as it were, naked in the middle of this battle. Obviously Patroclus, right? Not Achilles. So, you know, the sort of divine stripping away of the ruse and leaving Patroclus there as himself, right? He has nothing. He has no spear. He has nothing to guard him. He's completely vulnerable in the middle of battle. As himself, right? No more protection by either the armor or the guise of Achilles, right? So what does it mean? How do you understand it? Does this mean that Patroclus has in some way betrayed his friendship to Achilles? You know, has Achilles betrayed Patroclus by putting him in this circumstance? So how do we understand it? We can keep puzzling over that, but I'd ask you to consider this. The helmet is now going from Patroclus, and as is the armor, from Patroclus, who is the second self of Achilles, the literal substitute, onto that enemy self of Achilles, who is the one who stabs Patroclus in the stomach with the spear. They're both acting as Achilles, right? So it's an extraordinary kind of complex relation we're looking at here. And when Achilles gets the news of Patroclus' death, I think that's when you see, this is in book 18, we did this actually last year, you know, looking at when the news comes and Thetis down in the depths of the sea with all the Nereids around her begins this kind of keening, you know, and she's not mourning the death of Patroclus, she's mourning the death of Achilles. Because as soon as Patroclus dies, she knows that her son will re-enter the fighting and that his own death is now inevitable. So it's extraordinary when she comes up out of the sea and almost like, you know, Achilles mocking Patroclus, she almost mocks him. Something the matter, right? It's kind of harsh, but in any case, the depth of suffering that Achilles undergoes with the death of his friend is I think the indication of how, you know, deep that friendship was that we didn't see, you know, because of the whole honor being so much in the forefront of what was going on. All right, let's switch to Ishmael and Queequeg. This doesn't require as much context. The important thing with Moby Dick to me always seems to be getting the tone right, because it is often what you would now describe as snarky. You know, it's got this kind of smart alecky tone to the whole thing, particularly with Ishmael. At the very beginning of Moby Dick, Ishmael, he says, "Call me Ishmael." You might have heard that. Why Ishmael? Because he's not Isaac. He's not considering himself in the line of the covenant, or you could say he's differently covenanted or something. But he's not part of that that strain, you know, going through the Puritans of a certain kind of orthodoxy. Ishmael is more or less suicidal. He's walking around, following up, you know, funeral processions, hanging around coffin warehouses. You know, he's pretty sardonic about it, but he's not in the best frame of mind. He's been a country school teacher somewhere. He's just sort of at loose ends, and he decides that the obvious thing to do in these circumstances is to go whaling. You want to commit suicide? Here's a way to do it. Yeah. The more you find out about 19th century whaling, the more you see that's not altogether untrue. But he goes to New Bedford, Massachusetts, looks around for somewhere to stay, and finds this place called the Spouter Inn, proprietor Peter Coffin. You know, what do you want? Unfortunately, all the beds are taken. Peter Coffin says he can sleep on the bench out there, but, you know, Ishmael carves on it, tries to get it a little more comfortable, but never quite works because of the draft coming up by the wall. So the proprietor tells him, "Well, there's a bed you could share." Now, y'all from, you know, this used to be the common practice in hotels. You could, you know, if they didn't have enough rooms for you to have your own, you could always share a bed. with some complete stranger. But it turns out that the complete stranger that the proprietor is offering him is a cannibal. So on that particular night, this cannibal is out selling his heads. So apparently he has a stockpile of shrunken heads that he's been going out to try to sell to the folks in New Bedford. This is somewhat alarming to Ishmael, you know, but the proprietor tells him that, you know, go on up, you know, maybe he'll be a little late getting in. But so Ishmael finally agrees to do it and is just settling down to sleep when Queequeg comes in. Now, Queequeg has a shaved head with a top knot. He's completely tattooed over his whole body. He's kind of blue. It's multicolored, actually. But Ishmael is highly alarmed. They get in the bed, and finally Queequeg gets in the bed, and Ishmael cries out, I think because, is it Queequeg smoking? That's what it is, right? And so Queequeg, you know, who are you, right? So trying to find out who Ishmael is. They make it through that night, and then the next day, Ishmael goes to the whaleman's chapel, where the preacher there is a man named Father Mapple, who gives a long and very engaging and interesting sermon on Jonah that Ishmael hears and then comes back to the Spouter Inn and finds Queequeg, you know, with his book, as we see in this short chapter. So I just want to read a little of it. This is after he's described Queequeg as George Washington cannibalistically developed. Has that same sort of sloping head, you know, the whole thing. It's described the Socratic demeanor of Queequeg. As I sat there in that now lonely room, the fire burning low in that mild stage when after its first intensity has warmed the air, it then only glows to be looked at. The evening shades and phantoms gathering round the casements and peering in upon us, silent, solitary twain. The storm booming without in solemn swells. I began to be sensible of strange feelings. I felt a melting in me. No more my splintered heart and maddened hand were turned against the wolfish world. This soothing savage had redeemed it. There he sat, his very indifference speaking a nature in which there lurked no civilized hypocrisies and bland deceits. Wild he was, a very sight of sights to see. Yet I began to feel myself mysteriously drawn towards him. And those same things that would have repelled most others, they were the very magnets that thus drew me. I'll try a pagan friend, thought I, since Christian kindness has proved but hollow courtesy. I drew my bench near him and made some friendly signs and hints in doing my best to talk with him meanwhile. First, he little noticed these advances, but presently, upon my referring to his last night's hospitalities, he made out to ask me whether we were again to be bedfellows. I told him yes, whereat I thought he looked pleased, perhaps a little complimented. And then Ishmael takes the book. Now, you remember, Queequeg has this sort of fat volume, and he keeps turning the pages. He'll get up to 50 and go, and then start over, right? To another 50. Oh, right, there's so many pages in this thing, right? Some of our students do that with Moby Dick, right? But so Ishmael tries to describe to him what this is, the purpose of the printing, the meaning of these pictures, right? What this is all about. And, you know, he engages Queequeg's interest, and then they start talking, they share a smoke. And suddenly they are bosom friends. They're even married, right? As Queequeg puts it in his idiom. So, what do we make of this? Why do you think Melville centers his own discussion of friendship on this pairing? You know, this kind of deracinated melancholy, you know, guy who's read too much and who's full of kind of suicidal urges. He's obviously lost his faith, if he ever had any, right? He was brought up by Presbyterians, as we will shortly find out. So instead of finding some guy like himself, he finds Queequeg, and just sort of looking at him, right, begins to feel this interesting phrasing, felt a melting in me. It's like something that had been icy, you know, something that had been hardened in you begins to give way because of this soothing savage. A figure who would be much more at home in the Iliadic world. I mean, Queequeg, right? I mean, he's out there, he's a harpooner. You know, his job is to go after these massive, you know, whales and track them down in the deep and kill them, and you see all the other things that Queequeg does in the course of the book. He has a kind of heroic mold, you know. He saves a guy on the way out to Nantucket. He's fearless. So why this character? Because it strikes me, not only are we looking at a kind of combination of, you know, the civilized, well-read, literate, right, American and the savage, you know, noble savage, whatever you want to call him, right? But we're also looking at ancient and modern. You know, there's a way that we're also getting that doubling. So what's Melville getting at with this pairing, right? What is it that, I mean, it's almost like this is addressing a need in the modern soul or something like that, right? He's lost his sense of belonging in the world, right? Whereas Queequeg sits there with this philosophic at-homeness, if you put it that way. You know, he's Socratic. He's not, you know, he's not textual, but he certainly feels his place in the world. He has a dignity to him that's evident to everybody, right? He seems much more self-sufficient than anybody else around Ishmael. So it's a kind of redress. Something that was missing in Ishmael is fulfilled by Queequeg, and maybe the same for Queequeg, right? He gets this friend who is part of the world, which he knows he himself can never really enter, but you know, the two of them together have some kind of new thing. Were you troubled by Ishmael's rapid turn to idolatry here at the end? okay, right. Little Yojo is a pretty potent guy, you know. Shave his nose a little bit, offer him some shavings, you know. This echoes Falstaff's. When you know Falstaff in the Henry IV plays, he has a sort of cowardly catechism on honor, in which he talks himself into believing it's just a puff of air, that word honor, you know, so he gets rid of it. Ishmael quickly talks himself into offering a few shavings to Yojo, as this little idol is called. I think the note is entirely too serious for the tone of this passage, but in any case. Well, we better stop there. We've got, you know, again, a couple of instances of friendship, and especially the tensions, you know, that have to do with honor, with respect to friendship, and this kind of complementarity that we might see in friendship with Queequeg and Ishmael.
After hearing Dr. Arbery speak, I made up my mind to reread Moby Dick this summer, enjoying Ishmael's snark, but paying particular attention to his friendship with Queequeg. As it is with most people, my friends tend to be folks like me. And while that's fine and to be expected, friendships with those who are not like us open us up to new opportunities for growth, discovery, and community. The story of Ishmael and Queequeg feeds our imagination as to what that might look like. Knowing I probably will say this about all the works we considered at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, let me just add that if you're looking for summer reading, Moby Dick or the Iliad are great choices. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.